Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Let's say at this point that we've done most of the informational business, both for general military and then the LDS piece of it. But I think more of this LDS piece and interaction with others is going to come up in this next part a little bit. But I want to just hear from each of you guys, sort of maybe in rotation, experiences or whatever that sort of will give us the flavor of what it really is like to be a military chaplain and any LDS pieces. So either you can be on all this can be focused on LDS or some just like the day-to-day challenges, blessings, opportunities. I want to peek behind the curtain what your life is like. So if we can just start, let's, Jason, I haven't had you probably talk as much, so if you don't mind starting out each time, we'll go to Jason, Phil, Nathan, Jason, Phil, Nathan, and you guys just, let's just riff. I'll mostly stay quiet.
Okay. You know, I guess I'll start with, you know, just my experience in my first unit, you know, coming out of divinity school and coming out of doing a residency as a hospital chaplain at a hospital in northern Chicago and getting thrown into this, the world of the Army. Unlike Nathan, I had no prior military experience at all. So I pretty much had no idea what I was doing from an Army point of view, and the unit I was attached to coming out of my chaplain basic training was an infantry unit, and we were headed to Iraq immediately. So there was no time to sit and get ready and kind of slowly figure out what the Army was all about, because we were packing our bags. So I graduated from the chaplain school in September, and October I was on an airplane to Kuwait, and we were headed to Iraq after that. And so, you know, I had to get a run to keep up and figure out what I was doing. But down range while in Iraq with my soldiers, you know, a pretty varied approach to what ministry was. You know, Nathan mentioned the notion of ministry of presence earlier, and that's, you know, just being available, being where they are, and offering that on the spot ministry, whether it's just somebody who pulls you aside while you're visiting the motor pool saying, "Hey, chaplain, can I talk to you for a minute? You know, I had a bad phone call with my wife last night. We're not getting along." And then, you know, there you are. You're offering counseling right there in a Humvee. It's not in my office. It's sitting at my desk, but it's right there where you are. So that was part of my day to day, is just finding the soldiers wherever they are and being with them. We were in Western Baghdad at the time. The unit was stationed out of the Baghdad International Airport area, BIOP. But we had smaller company sized units kind of dotting the countryside there west of Baghdad. They were these little outposts, and so I would go. I'd visit them. I'd hop on a convoy and drive out there with the supply convoy or and visit with them, see how they're doing, talk to them, check up on the morale, just be a friend to them and let them know that I loved them and I was there for them. Offer a worship service when I could, you know. Maybe you get who's ever around at the moment. Maybe half the company is on patrol and a few others are pulling guard duty, but whoever's around at the moment, you pull them together if they want to and do a 20-minute worship service where we sing a couple songs, say some prayers for each other, and I'd offer a meditation or a short sermon. And so just getting to where they are was a big part of my experience in Iraq.
Thank you so much. And feel free, you and also Nathan, who I know you were deployed as well twice, you said, tell us, you know, whenever you need to draw the differences between being in a combat theater versus being at home too. But I'm going to go to Phil next for a peek behind the curtain of a chaplain type of stuff that you do.
All you can do is a peek, because it is a fascinating job with so many dimensions to it. And the neat thing about it is there's just so many different things happening every day. And there's so many different things that you can initiate and do to improve the situation at a base in particular. So creativity is heavily involved. My first base was a training base, a technical training base. And because I'd run what they considered a student center, like the Institute, they put me in charge of the coffee house ministry. So I ran a gigantic coffee house. We served probably 300 or 400 tech training students a day. We taught values education classes, did tons of counseling, did religious services. So that was a fascinating experience. Most Air Force bases have only about 5 chaplains, unlike some Army bases that have tons. And we're responsible for a full chapel program. So you're doing a variety of worship services, Sunday schools, men's groups, women's groups, Bible studies, marriage retreats. There's just no end to the kinds of programs you can do. I was at a place one time where we just had too many people marrying the wrong person at the wrong time. So I started a series called Look Before You Leap, and it was essentially a here's why you shouldn't get married now kind of class. And I measured success by how many people came up to me and said, gee, we canceled our marriage. Thanks, chaplain. So you see a need, and then you develop programming to meet that need. Because the chaplain is the only person that a military member can come to and talk about anything confidentially, we get most of the counseling. And they come with all kinds of serious sorts of issues and problems. And so trying to manage all of those programs, manage a heavy counseling load is quite a chore. One interesting experience I had was it was a deployment to Cuba in 94-95 during that situation where we had all those Haitians and Cubans trying to get into Florida, and the Navy fished them out of the waters there and stuck them in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, behind barbed wire. And they didn't want to be there, and there were 28,000 Haitians and Cubans, and they were rioting, and they were having the poor Army MPs were just having a hard time trying to figure out what to do with those folks. Some general decided to throw a bunch of chaplains in there, and a very unique use of chaplains where we're serving foreign civilians rather than American military members. But they tossed about 75 chaplains and 75 chaplain assistants into the middle of that. And we had about 5 per camp, and the camps were about 3,500 people each. And we had a mixed group of Army, Air Force, Navy chaplains. And actually, we went into those camps, learned out what the needs were, what the problems were, provided solutions for a lot of those things. The rioting went way down. We started providing programs and religious services and different things. And it really made that situation more peaceful until, government leaders could figure out what to do with all those folks. As you move along in your career, you start becoming a supervisor. Then you've got to be concerned about the junior chaplains and what schools they go to, what training they get, are they functioning appropriately, and that sort of thing. Then weird stuff happens. In the Air Force, Sunday's a big work day for a chaplain, so you don't go to the LDS ward, but your family's going. So we had been at a place for a couple of years, and most Latter-day Saints don't realize that there are LDS chaplains. And I was actually the senior pastor for the 10 o'clock service at the base where I was at. And I'm preaching every Sunday and taking care of the pastoral care programs. Well, anyway, one day the missionaries were tracting in the town there, and they knocked on the door of these people, and they said, hi, we're with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the lady said, oh, yeah, I know about you. She said, the pastor at our church is a Mormon. And she said, if we have any questions, we'll just ask him.
Oh, man.
Well, the poor missionary is scratching his head, and he's saying to this lady, I don't think that's possible. We don't have pastors in another church. And she says, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure. George, isn't Chaplain McLemore a Mormon? Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Pretty sure he is. And, yeah, he's the pastor of our church on the base there. So cool. it just so happened that two Sundays later, I showed up at church. I hadn't been there for 2 years. And I showed up one Sunday mainly because a gentleman in our single adult in our ward had asked my wife out on a date. He thought she was unmarried.
Yeah.
So I showed up on a testimony meeting so I could get up front and bear my testimony. I'm married to that lady in the front row, hands off.
But in my wife often refers to herself as a church widow, so yeah.
So anyway, the missionaries saw me there, and you could just see them putting all the little pieces together, right? And that's when it first dawned on them that, you know, I was this pastor of these people's church on the base. And it's, you know, suddenly made sense to him. So you do get some odd sorts of things that pop up.
Awesome. Hey, we'll make another round. Let's go to Nathan for a few, but we'll just keep coming around. So Phil, keep your stories going in a minute.
Okay.
But Nathan, what would be your next move to point out?
Yeah, I think this is fun. I'll just kind of pick up where Phil left off, and I feel compelled to, no pun intended, to let you know that many Army assignments sound much, to me anyway, like your Air Force. I've worked for chaplains, directly for chaplains before, and I've been a pastor at Protestant services. Now, perhaps something, it seems to me like it is a new emphasis that the brethren are placing in setting apart new chaplains. We were specifically told by Elder Oaks and then a number of other times, whenever possible, to worship as a family, which has meant at several of my assignments that I've brought my family with me to the Protestant service. And, you know, maybe one Sunday a month we would go to the ward together. But, you know, our oldest son, who's 14 now, when we were in Germany in my previous assignment, you know, he went through confirmation class with the other 11 and 12-year-old children to prepared to take communion for the first time, which he didn't. But the six-month-long course, which took place during Sunday school of the Protestant service, you know, was very educational for him. He's also preparing for ordination to the Aaronic priesthood, and his mother and I were monitoring him carefully and engaging him in conversation from time to time to make sure that we weren't screwing him up too badly. But from what we can tell now, at the age of 14, it really has complemented his experience and made him more respectful of others, more aware. And, you know, we certainly see the look of confusion cross his brow from time to time, but I wouldn't call that unhealthy, and I don't have any serious concerns. But at the same time, there is some hesitation that we both have. But with a primary program and how rich a cultural experience that is within the church, it's kind of difficult to have my family join me. And so we try to strike a balance. If there's a ward that meets at a different time, you know, that there are a number of things that you can do so that you can try to do both. But we haven't discovered a way in which to do it perfectly. And then, you know, Jason's experiences in combat, maybe a story I'll share this time around. During my first deployment in 2005, I was with the 3rd Infantry Division, and we were in Tikrit, and up in Kirkuk, the 116th Field Artillery Brigade, it was a National Guard unit out of Idaho, had 7 chaplains, none of whom were LDS, but there were about 3,000 soldiers who were LDS. So every other month, my chaplain assistant and I would jump on a Blackhawk, and we would take the hour-long flight up to Kirkuk to train the group leaders to facilitate a healthier relationship between the Latter-day Saints, the group leaders, and their unit chaplains, which wasn't bad. There was just room for improvement. And I'll tell you, the first time that we got off the Blackhawk, a couple of the battalion commanders, the brigade deputy commander, the brigade chaplain, and several of the chaplains were waiting there for me to get off, and I felt like a rock star. For the next several days, they had everything laid out. They had our quarters, you know, set aside, transportation for us throughout the forward operating base. And on Sunday, there were 3 different sacrament meetings across the basin at different times, and each one had anywhere between 150 to 300, which was very, very different from the onesies and twosies that I would experience back when I was in my area of operations, and I would get in the Humvee with my chaplain assistant, and we would be part of a armored convoy, and we would jump off, and I would meet with the LDS soldiers when it was feasible. Most of the time I was doing general Protestant services, but when there was an LDS soldier, we would stay a little longer and visit, have a sacrament meeting on the hood of a Humvee or on the back of a Bradley or whatever the case might be. And so there was a contrast during my first deployment of very, very large numbers with an overall inner Rocky Mountain area
feel or whatever.
Yeah, right. And then we come back to, you know, active duty Army, because all these guys were National Guard and they worked with each other, and so-and-so might be my high councilman or in our state presidency at home, but here he was brother so-and-so and he was a sergeant major, or, you know, he was a lieutenant or something. And a very, very strange world for me to see up close from an active duty perspective, and one that helped me really appreciate how diverse our military is. When, during both deployments, and it wasn't as if I wasn't already too busy, I implemented a haircut ministry. Now, when we're not deployed, it's easy to find a bunch of different places to get your hair cut. But when you're out there in Iraq, for instance, it can be, you know, pretty challenging. So I brought along a pretty nice set of professional hair clippers. I didn't have any skill, but early on it didn't seem to really matter. Over time I developed the ability to provide just about any haircut. And as I would go from place to place and would do worship services, I'd also, you know, provide haircuts, free haircuts, of course, and, you know, do anywhere between 5 and 20 haircuts. And it would be hot and sweaty, and the soldiers would be dirty. And I just kind of had to look past it and, you know, push on. And it allowed me to get to know the soldiers really well. During my early part of my second deployment, however, there was one soldier who was a mechanic. And, you know, he came in, and it was for a haircut on the Saturdays at the chapel when I happened to be by for that. And it was apparent that he took no thought into cleaning up before coming in for a haircut. And I gave him a water bottle and told him to go rinse off his hair, which he did. And he came back in, and as I was getting ready to, you know, cut his hair, he was just as filthy as any of the other soldiers. And I just thought for a moment about, I don't know, my reservations. And the thought occurred to me of how similar cutting hair was to offering a priesthood blessing. And you're standing behind a person who's sitting down, you're touching parts of his head, you're putting oil on the blade of the clippers, and you're talking about the most intimate things, you know, the person's family, you know, fears with combat, college football, which I always, you know, enjoy. And they're really letting you in your space. And there is a sense in which you're not just doing, you know, providing a menial task, because the thought crossed my mind a couple of times. Yeah, all this graduate education, professional experience has led me to cutting hair. And the thought very quickly came of, you know, clarification. This is meaningful ministry. And if Jesus could wash feet, why can't you cut soldiers' hair? And, of course, that, you know, that centered me very, very quickly, that chastisement. And it was, you know, meaningful. So I've provided, you know, probably a couple thousand haircuts over time, and have gotten real sure shoulders and more deeply appreciate the service that provided to me by barbers now. And that's something that's not within, they didn't teach us that at the chaplain officer basic course, or, you know, the church didn't outline that. So I think most chaplains have very innovative ministries which they address any of a variety of particular needs of soldiers and family members, and that's one that's meaningful to me.
Thank you. We're going to keep going around. Jason, there, I want to move to you in a second. There was something that came up in Phil's that I didn't want to let get too far away, and I'd forgotten right after he'd finished. Phil, you mentioned that the chaplain is the confidant because he's the only one. Only with the chaplain can you assure full confidentiality. And I guess what I wanted to ask is, there are military psychiatrists and psychologists and stuff, but doctor-patient doesn't work with them at the same level that, you know, confessor-confessee does?
No, because they're duty-bound to report anything that would cause a commander to consider them unfit for duty. And we would get tons of airmen to come see us. Going to mental health was the kiss of death, because the mental health officer could easily call your commander a first sergeant, and all of a sudden you're starting to get bad performance reports. So they tended to come see us to try to solve problems because it was confidential, and that did create some problems for us. You got people confessing crimes and intended crimes and abuse of various sorts, and trying to sort out the confidentiality in the midst of murder and child abuse and all that stuff gets to be quite artful. So it's the one reason why, at least in the Air Force, the counseling load was so high for us, because it was the one confidential place. And there was some conflict with it among chaplains. Some chaplains did not want to maintain full confidentiality, and it just takes one chaplain to blow it, and you're blown for years. People won't come and see you. So, I used to do briefings with commanders on confidentiality, and they get nervous when people are coming over. They got some serious problems. At the same time, do they want to risk people not coming and getting help? You might have a bad incident for every 400 or 500 people you see. Do you want 400 or 500 people helped at the risk of this one bad thing, or do you want us to start? If they wanted us to start reporting stuff, and nobody was going to come see us. So there is kind of a built-in tension there. It's up to the chaplain to try to maintain the confidentiality, but make sure nothing bad happens or continues to happen to people, particularly in cases of abuse.
Aren't there laws in place, though, now that clergy, patient, client, the privilege doesn't work in certain types of crimes that they might commit? Is that different in the military than it is in civilian legal code?
Dan, my understanding there is that a judge would have to rule that the person did not expect privileged communication or confidentiality. But if it can be shown that the person was speaking to his or her chaplain with the expectation of confidentiality or privileged communication, then there's nothing that can be done.
Yeah, see, I was taught, there are military bases in states that require the reporting of certain events and so forth. But I was always taught that the military base is federal property, and if we're doing our work on federal property, then we could maintain confidentiality in spite of the state laws.
That's my understanding as well.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Now, morally, it creates some problems, and you do get into some dicey sorts of situations, but if you violate the confidentiality, I went to a base where a chaplain had talked, turned somebody in. I noticed our counseling was way below any other base. I went out on the flight line to talk to the guys, and they just flat out said, "Chaplain, the word's out. You guys don't keep your word. Nobody's coming to see you." And it took 2 years of hard work to turn that around, where people would come see us with confidence.
Wow. Jason, what other story or angle do you want to give us a peek at?
Well, I mean, when I spoke the last time, I talked to you a little bit about my combat deployment, and my context for ministry now is quite different, right? I'm not with an infantry battalion in Iraq anymore. I work in a hospital. And so I think the original question was, what is it that we do, or what is the life of a chaplain? And right now, my focus right now is the question of suffering, right? And as a hospital chaplain, I'm engaged with individuals who are suffering, and some wound, some illness, some injury has brought them to this hospital, and so now. I have a role in their life if they'll let me in. So you know, since I'm one of the junior chaplains in our department, rather than spending all my time in various administrative meetings, I'm free to do pastoral care. And so what I do as a chaplain is I visit with people who are suffering. I sit with them in their suffering and talk to them about what it is for them to grapple with diagnosis of cancer, what it is for them to receive the news that they're HIV positive, to sit with them as they grapple with wounds that their bodies are never going to fully heal from. And so, you know, this question of suffering and pastoral care, this is kind of where I am at in my career, my service as a chaplain, sitting in there and hearing their pain and talking to them and helping them to discover, you know, those partial fragments of meaning or hope that they have that they can hold on to, and that's gonna see them through, you know, the healing process, or that's gonna see them through as they create a new normal in their lives. You know, it's not about me answering their suffering with whatever my theodicy happens to be. It's about sitting with them in their pain and letting them know that they're not alone, and reminding them of what they do have in their life that's hopefully going to see them through this. And so I find, you know, and some of that certainly, you know, that kind of pastoral care is the kind of, you know, care that I did offer my infantry soldiers as well. But the context of a hospital and what I do now is just it's a bit different, sitting in a group with whether it's one-on-one patient visits in a hospital room, or whether it's, you know, I once a week I go up to our inpatient psychiatry and I you know, do kind of lead a broadly spiritual discussion with the soldiers who up there about how we find meaning in suffering or about what hope is. And so that's where my care is at right now, and it's deeply meaningful, but it's exhausting as well.
Oh, I bet. Wow, heavy stuff. Thank you so much, though, Jason. And do you think that are you naturally gravitating towards this work, or is this just more the assignment and kind of that, you know, you want to get experience in all the different types of ministry?
I gravitate towards it. As I was wrapping up my studies at the University of Chicago, I did a 9-month-long residency for chaplains at a hospital there, and really just got a taste for healthcare ministry. And so when I came into the Army, I volunteered for opportunities to, again, do more clinical-based ministry. And so the Army, I think Nathan mentioned earlier that the Army likes to keep your assignments varied, right? They don't want you staying in one place for too long. But I think for me, the Army healthcare system will always be kind of a home where I kind of keep coming back to. So, you know, I'll probably go and do a different assignment here and, you know, go do a training or go back to the infantry or something like that. And then keep coming back, though, to the Army healthcare system, just because I think healthcare ministry is just it really is an opportunity just to meet people who at that moment feel like they're one of the least of these, right? I think one of my great scriptural paradigms for ministry is Matthew 25, and so I'm always looking, who are the least of these, and certainly those whose bodies have betrayed them, or those who are grappling with mental illness, certainly feel like they're the least of these. Not that they're least in any ontological sense,
right?
But that they feel least, that they're feeling put out or ostracized or broken. You know, I mean, the Army does not have the Army wants you working. The Army wants you functional, and if you're not, then you're broke. And that can be tough for a soldier to sit and to think of themselves as being broke, right? I'm broke because I have PTSD, and so I'm mentally broke, or I'm emotionally broke. I'm broke because, you know, that last IED blast hurt my body to the point to where I can't be a soldier anymore, and I'm no longer any good to the Army, so I got to get out, right? So this sense of being broke is something that I try to reach out and minister to or reframe.
Thank you very much. Phil, some more stories or observations about chaplain life?
Yeah, again, it's the variety that's so fascinating. You know, you could be at a fighter base working with fighter pilots and support folks. When I was up at Elmendorf, I got to fly with the AWACS, you know, those radar planes. And the mission then was to intercept Russian fighters coming over the North Pole trying to sneak into our airspace. And we'd go up there and detect them, and then our fighters, F-15s, would chase them back home. And one of the few times you're kind of involved up in a flying ministry, when I was at the missile base at Malmstrom, we have hundreds of ICBMs, you know, underground, and the missile officers that launch those are, you know, they're in metal capsules way down under the ground. And one of my jobs was to travel all over the state of Montana where we had officers buried underneath, and I'd go down into their capsules and visit with them, provide whatever spiritual services were appropriate. At my first base, when I was the junior chaplain, we had a large gospel service. A gospel service typically is a black service. They're quite fun, exuberant preaching and trombones and guitars and a soul choir that just sounds fantastic. And we had lost our black chaplain, and they needed one of the white chaplains to take over that gospel service for 8 months until we could get a new black chaplain there to take over that service. Well, no, there wasn't a white chaplain on the base that wanted to do it. I was the junior, so they just kind of all stared at me, and that was my next job. So it's a little odd, you know, to be the only white face in a service, and you're the leader. And I have to say, you know, and a Mormon on top of that. So
yeah.
In the early 80s, so figure that out. In any case, I'm telling you, man, that music picks up. It's hopping. It's a lot of fun. You start preaching, you get feedback. You know, I made some point, you know, in an exuberant way, and that, you know, the guys on the front row, that's right, chaplain, you tell them, man, you tell them. Well, you know, pretty soon you think, I am right. I am telling them, you know. And you, you know, you're pounding that pulpit pretty good, and it's a rather exuberant experience. So integrating family is important. I used to, our sacrament meetings were always during our chapel service time, so it was hard for my family to attend too many services. But my daughter, I had three daughters that had harmonic voices, and I would bring them over every couple of months to sing in the chapel service. They were always the featured singers at our Christmas Eve service, and they loved the chapel, and the chapel folks loved them, and that worked out quite well. My son, on the other hand, who was 6 and 7 at that age, he never could quite figure out what I was up to. I would leave the house, and he'd say, are you going to the true church or to your church today?
Uh-huh.
And so he had a couple of years of trying to sort that out. Sometimes it's political stuff you're involved in. My last assignment as the senior chaplain at a base in New Mexico, we had Wiccans who wanted to start meeting in the base chapel. And the Protestant community threatened to completely revolt if any Wiccan held any kind of satanic service in the chapel. The commander said I had to accommodate him in some way, which I had to. So
clarify that Wiccans are not Satanists. That was just a perception on other folks.
Yeah, no, okay. It's more worship. And
right, right.
And it was the perception of the Protestant community, and they were just completely freaked out that their chapel was going to be desecrated and they'd never be able to go back in.
Right.
I actually met with them, told them what was acceptable and not acceptable as far as the kinds of things they could do, but I wanted them to feel welcome. I did ask if they would be willing to meet in a multipurpose room since the chapel itself wasn't really a requirement for their needs. They agreed to do that, and it seemed to work well, although there were a core of people that were so angry at me for letting them in at all. They tried to get all of the teachers in the Vacation Bible School to resign so our Bible school would collapse. So sometimes you get involved in these kind of inter-religious feuds and conflicts, and you kind of have to find a way to sort all that out. The last thing I'll mention is as you move up in your career, sometimes you get some nice administrative jobs. You can work at a command office, and if you have the interest and ability and the liking, you can do some administrative things. I worked in a command office where I worked on budgets and chapel plans and chaplain training throughout a whole area. And I worked, went through the war planners course, learned how to do the chaplain portion of war plans and again, just an amazing variety of things that you can participate in, whether it's the full range of the military or whether it's the full range of human life in the families of military members.
It does sound like an amazing job, you guys. Wow. Sounds wonderful, but also very, very difficult. Nathan, where would you go next?
You know, February is a thoughtful time of year for me. In 2007, we were losing, on average, a soldier once every week to 10 days in Ramadi, what's come to be called the Battle for Ramadi, a highly kinetic situation. We had companies at several different outposts within the city, and then we in the headquarters were just outside the city on Camp Ramadi. And so I would spend my week staying with the soldiers on location, and countless times would sleep through small arms, you know, gunfire throughout the night, back and forth. And come back in when we would lose a soldier after counseling with, doing a traumatic stress debrief with those soldiers who were with the soldier killed in action, come back, do a memorial service, be at what we call Charlie Med, or the aid station in the morgue where the soldier came in, and then head back out to the city only to do it again. And it seemed like we did that for a few months until there was a giant operation in which we cleaned the city, if you will, of the insurgents. Shortly thereafter, our battalion, combined arms battalion with about 1,500 soldiers and Marines, went just north of the city, and our mission changed considerably, just as the mission had changed, in the city. We were now meeting with local leaders, sheikhs, and my commander, knowing my background working with leaders of other religions prior to coming on in the chaplaincy, had let me know, hey, if an opportunity comes up, I plan to use you, and which I was happy to do. And so we met with a tribal leader, my commander did, and let him know, hey, look, the next time I come, I would like my chaplain, my imam, to meet with your imams. And he was very much agreeing. Now, keep in mind, this is the Sunni Triangle. It was a time where just less than a year ago, statements coming out of the Department of Defense were calling the city of Ramadi and Fallujah lost because of Al-Qaeda in Iraq having it as its headquarters. Well, in a pleasant, surprising fashion, this had changed, and so we were now looking at building relationships with local leaders, building them up, etc. And so when I had the opportunity to meet with Sheikh Hais in May of 2007, he introduced me to a gentleman who was simultaneously a sheikh and the chief imam for the region, Sheikh Abdullah. And we entered into a dialogue. I met with some of the other imams of the region through him. And some of the initiatives that came about as a result of that relationship, we involved several of the imams to come to our location and to train our company commanders on how to best respect Iraqi police and Iraqi army who are working with us during the month of Ramadan. And the mutual respect, granted we had interpreters there to pass these things through, but the mutual respect was very evident. We had elementary schools back in Georgia near Fort Stewart, where the 3rd Infantry Division is based, that were raising funds and collecting school supplies, sending those to us. One school of which was had a large number of orphans attend the school, and so after they collected the school supplies, they couldn't afford to send them to us, and so they had an additional initiative called Pennies for Postage, in which they raised over $5,000 to then send all these school supplies to us. Well, where it would be typical for the United States military to go out and hand these out, our initiative during the month of Ramadan, which an observant Muslim believes that kindness given during this time is considered an even more pious or righteous act, what we did is we helped empower the religious leaders with the local schools. And so they would go in with us, but they would be the ones who would physically be handing over the supplies to the principals, the school teachers, and the hordes of children that were there. A very positive experience. So at the end of this 15-month deployment, or near the end anyway, I had the very rare experience of taking many of our soldiers on tours back down into the city, where once, you know, this was a fire pit, meaning that this is where snipers would engage enemy, or where enemy snipers would be nest up in that building, or we had this firefight here. IEDs would often go off on this particular street, which we'd call IED Alley. Now the city had been in the throes of renovation, and there were marketplaces and schools, and therapeutic for the soldiers to see that. Difficult for them to come to grips with it when their buddy had been killed there, and they knew that those same people who were in that market were some of the same people that they had come to distrust. They couldn't discount the stability that was taking place and the Iraqi police stations growing. So that for me was a high point in my ministry.
Wow, thank you. Powerful. We could go on forever, guys, but we kind of wanted to limit it. I want to have you guys have one final round, and it seems to me like in these stories that you've talked about so far, you haven't really talked too much about the LDS piece of it. So how about this for a final round? I'd love to have you guys reflect on your own spiritual journeys as impacted by the experience of being a chaplain, doing the different types of ministries, having the experiences you have, but also sort of interaction with your life as a Latter-day Saint and your testimony, or the fact that you're doing your spiritual journey with Mormonism as your primary community. So does that seem fair, like a final round, sort of the blessings in your own life from this, and especially as it relates to Mormonism and your own growth? Jason, or is that too quick to throw right to you, or would you be ready to reflect on that?
You know, for me, I mean, the great blessing of being able to serve as an Army chaplain is I see it as part of my own redemptive process. You know, for me, I recognize that I feel closest to the Spirit. I feel closest to my Father in heaven and to the Savior while I'm reaching out to those who are in need. I'm offering what help, what blessing I can, right? If the way we define priesthood in the church, there's always a couple of definitions that get thrown out, but the word service is almost always part of that definition, that to be a part of the priesthood is to offer service. And so so that's where my Latter-day Saint identity kind of kicks into what it means for me to be a chaplain, right? Because nobody, when I was in divinity school at the University of Chicago, nobody came to me and said, "Brother Unsworth, we thought about it, we prayed about it, we want you to be a chaplain," right? That the top-down calling doesn't really fit this mold, right? This was an internal call. This is something that arose within me and my relationship with my Father in heaven and the Spirit, and something that I had to follow and kind of chase down. And so for me, the great blessing then is to be able then to live this priesthood ideal of what it means to reach out and to serve, you know, those in the military community, to serve those who are suffering, who experience just tremendous hardships, and to do it not in a way that I think one of the most common misperceptions of military chaplaincy is that we're these cheerleaders for whatever the current war is, right? That we go up before these formations and we say, "Well, God wants us to go over there and to kill all these people, and it's okay because we're doing God's work." And that, of course, that's not the case. You know, certainly military chaplaincy is attention filled and complex ministry. And unfortunately, I've actually known a few chaplains that kind of take that, you know, let's cheerlead the current war kind of mentality. But for the vast majority of us, whether LDS or not, I think we recognize what a complex ministry this is, and what an opportunity there is then to reach out to serve the soldiers that feel these same tensions in their own life. And as chaplains, we are at a tremendously we hold a tremendously crucial role in that, you know, in that that as chaplains, we are part of the institution, right? I am a soldier. I am an officer. I have rank. You know, I'm salaried by the military. I'm part of the institution. But my primary authority, my primary sense of identity comes from something other than the institution, right? It comes from the church. It comes from my own sense of testimony. And it's that being part of that, that sense of being an insider, but also an outsider, because again, my primary identity comes from outside of the institution of the military. It's exactly that tension that allows me to speak prophetically to the institution of the military, to advocate for soldiers who are experiencing moral difficulties, who are advocate for soldiers whose life context, whether it's their families or their own struggles, just make military service difficult for them, and being an advocate for them or being at least a listening ear. So all of that taken together is part of how I define my priesthood identity and what it means to serve is to reach out and to be able to speak prophetically, to be able to listen with, you know, with compassion and empathy. And as I do that, I recognize, you know, the Spirit in my life. I recognize my own needs for when I need someone to listen to me or to speak a prophetic word to me. I pay closer attention to it now because I'm out there trying to do it myself, and so I try to be aware of my own needs for it. So, anyways, hopefully that's not too much rambling, but
fantastic.
But the blessings for me, I try and boil it down to, you know, this notion of priesthood as service. And if I could just find a way to get out there to serve, to practice compassion, then I've had a good day.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you for being on. Phil, where would you go with your experience those 20 years in the Air Force chaplaincy kind of affected your spiritual journey?
Boy, you know, I found two kinds of people in the military. There were people who joined up really out of selfish purposes. They were a bit frustrating. But there's so many people that become a part of the military to serve and to serve in an honorable way. And it was a privilege and an honor on my part to play some role in the support of these noble souls. You know, when your mission is to kill people and to break things, that brings up some interesting moral and ethical issues. And to have a job, to have a position where I could be a force for moral behavior, mature behavior, honorable behavior in the midst of whatever arises, I just found to be very significant and very spiritually enriching. Always looking for ways to support people where they could raise their vision of who and what they were and to live and to serve more honorably. It was an honor really to be at the crossroads of people's lives, sometimes joyful, sometimes in the midst of crises, but to be a stabilizing and a healing influence at these crossroads and in these crises I felt an honorable job. And to do that with legitimacy, you know, you have to have something to offer. I mean, you have to offer stability and you have to offer healing influence. And you can only do that if your own spiritual life is intact. And so I found this constantly being presented with the core issues of human life to be a daily reminder to me, or at least a daily, it put me on the daily quest of questioning, you know, what is the purpose of life? What does it mean to be a spiritual person in the middle of all of this stuff that happens in the military and in people's personal lives? And in the crisis of this human condition, you know, what is it in the gospel that really works and doesn't work? I came to the conclusion there's a lot of stuff that we do that really doesn't help people at the core. And so in dealing with this, you know, day to day, month after month, year after year, it really caused me to dig very deep into the what I consider to be the essence of spirituality and to the principles and practices and disciplines that really did cause a real inner transformation, which we're expected to do in the crisis of the human condition. Mm-hmm. You know, it was in that quest to discover what really works that, of course, moved me into this, where I am with this inner path of meditation and contemplative prayer and kind of inner spiritual work. And I have to credit a lot of that motivation to my experience in the chaplain service, you know, getting to the core of things. So at all levels, it was an incredible, very diverse experience and an amazing laboratory, so to speak, to clarify within myself what my positions and practices would be spiritually.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate having you on again too, Phil. Nathan, where would you bring us home in terms of your spiritual journey and this kind of tire meets the road ministry?
You know, a lot of what Phil says resonates with me, and even more so Jason, since we've got so much of our backgrounds in common. But I'll just kind of build off of that. I left my second deployment in Iraq for a 3-year assignment in Germany, where I had the often despised assignment of resource manager. And in the Army anyway, this is the responsibility where I'm overseeing the funds, both the congressional funds that come in, the taxpayers' funds, as well as the chapel tithes and offerings, all the contractors, the facilities, and it looks much more like an accountant's job than it does a minister's job. And I dreaded it. I welcomed the respite from the combat deployments and quality time with my family in Europe. But my attitude eventually changed. And, we pay lip service to every member in the church having responsibility, and none is truly more important in the sight of the Lord or building the kingdom than the other. And maybe I shouldn't be so cynical. In many instances, I was paying lip service and hadn't fully tasted of the richness of that principle. Our Protestant brothers and sisters sometimes refer to that as the priesthood of all believers, where everyone is involved. And I began to see that my involvement with the 20 women who were contractors and provided childcare services at our different worship services, and the musicians and the instructors, and their concerns about whether their contracts would be renewed or whether we'd have enough money to continue this particular program in the church. And a lot of that looks so unattractive on the outside, but when you prayerfully approach those responsibilities, it's as if you have a greater sense of appreciation with the ownership that you adopt. And so for me, I have been consistently busy in ministry as a chaplain, so that as I go in and out of my sessions of dealing with difficult questions that concern the church or relate to the gospel in general, or just religion in general, I have never been afforded the opportunity to focus explicitly and exclusively on these challenges in an academic or intellectual sense. I've always had to do it alongside of the service that both Jason and Phil mentioned. And although it seemed inconvenient at the time, in retrospect, what I've come to realize is that it's really the ideal way in which to do it. That the preoccupation I might have had as a young man with, the nature of the afterlife and the various degrees of glory and what one might call ontological concerns are completely off my radar screen, where for the past several years and currently right now, my concern in ministry is building the kingdom. And I don't mean that in an exclusively LDS sense, but how to be an instrument of peace in God's hand wherever I might be in the chaplaincy as it is. And it's been my experience that God is glorified in this. The church is reputation is having something to contribute to others' welfare and the greater common good is confirmed, and the satisfaction that goes along with it. And when you look to your left and your right as a chaplain, and in many instances you have as much affinity with someone outside your denomination as you might with someone within your denomination, that can really cause you to stop and pause. And for me, what I have taken away from that is that, you know, our more eternal nature as brothers and sisters to one another is far more meaningful, and I would say far more important in God's eyes. And so my identity as a child of God, doing His work in His kingdom together with my wife and our family as we try to wrestle through what that looks like, has been often exhausting, but almost always meaningful and rewarding. And I'm sure that that's the case for people outside the chaplaincy as it is for us, but it's so much more magnified or concentrated because of the demands that are placed upon us. So that's how I would summarize my final point for you.
Thank you. Sounds like you all like it, even though it's exhausting and challenging. And not everybody can be a military chaplain, but I really think what you guys talked about there with the tire meets the road and the administrative and the service and not just focusing on the intellectual or the theological and worrying about truth claims as much as, you know, core identity, suffering, you know, the least of these. To me, that's what you've said there can certainly be applied outward for anybody in whatever place they are. Oh, thank you guys very much for being on. And listeners, let me throw it out to you. Demand more time with these guys. We can do a follow-up. What are the questions that you have that we didn't get here? And so, you know, write through comments in the MormonMatters.org comment section of the blog. You know, either ask your questions there or say, you know, do another hour and focus on this or something. And, you know, I know you guys could have gone several more rounds with just really amazing stories, so maybe we will have you back as people engage. So I hope you'd be willing to do that. Was this too painful, you guys?
No,
not at all.
That was fun.
Good. Well, listeners, thank you for all that you do. Thanks for coming to the blog. Thanks for the support of Mormon Matters and the conversations that you're allowing that to be an influence. Appreciate anything you do when it comes to financial contributions to the podcast. That's a piece of my life that I would like to keep going strong. And just this podcast has been really rewarding for me. And you guys, all I want to say is, I don't want it to sound weird, but thank you for your service as an American, as a citizen of this country. You know, you've helped me appreciate the military, you know, at a new level. You've opened that up for me. And just that you guys are wearing out your life, even though it's your job and there's this career and there's some neat things about that stuff. You guys are truly people that I admire for the way that you where your job forces you to focus, but where you guys so clearly are just following the Spirit and the way you're called to it. So thank you very much. I hope that's okay to thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
It's been great. Thanks.
Thanks, you guys. And we'll engage you on the blog, and we'll just wish you good night. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.